Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. My guest today is Dr. Martin Donahue, and he's been on the Health and Healthcare Forum a few years back. He has a wonderful background for doing what he's doing. He's going to be talking about environmental and health consequences of GMO tonight in Corvallis. Today is the 9th of September. It's a good time to be talking about this topic. Well, welcome, Martin.
Yes, thank you. It's great to be here.
He has studied, of course, medicine. That was a first love, and then the various sciences that go along with that, and became very interested in public health and social justice, and went on a tour to work with Navajo people, among others. If you're interested in hearing more about his full background, you just have to go to kbu.fm and go to the search in the upper right and put in Martin Donahue. It comes right up.
Or you can simply go to my website, which is publichealthandsocialjustice.org, or more simply just phsj.org.
This is a very hot topic now, but Martin has been working with physicians for social responsibility on related issues for quite a long time. Let's see, there was, I think, an 8-year campaign for safe food, or for 8 years you were affiliated with it. It's probably still going on and we're part of it. Is that right?
That's correct. I was the science advisor, and this all began back in 2002 when there was a ballot measure, 27, which is very similar to Measure 92, which Oregon voters will decide this November. And that was designed to label genetically modified foods.
But there were other foods that you were involved with over that time period as well.
There were. We had some concerns about the use of recombinant bovine growth hormone, or RBGH, brand name Posilac, being used in dairy cattle in production of milk. And so we had a campaign to try to get dairies, not just in Oregon, but nationwide, to decrease their use of RBGH, to get restaurants and coffee shops and other places to opt out of using it, because we had some rather worrisome concerns about the possible health consequences of people being exposed to milk from RBGH-treated cattle, as well as the effects on the cattle themselves, which were quite unpleasant. And that campaign was fairly successful and culminated in the American Public Health Association's coming out against the use of artificial hormones in the meat and the milk supply. And I was one of the secondary co-authors of that APHA guideline, which came out a few years ago.
Well, that was a wonderful campaign, and it was very single-minded in a sense. Perhaps that was one reason it worked so effectively. But that was wonderful, and it gives some hope for doing some other things, and you're back at it again.
I am, and I think we have a good chance this time. Back in 2002, when the measure came out, we were quite confident that it would pass. One of the reasons for this was that polls at that time, and in fact polls today, show that 85 to 90% of Americans favor labeling of food that's produced through genetic engineering, which is the insertion of a gene from an unrelated organism into a crop. And most of these genes that are inserted are for pesticide resistance, and some are essentially turning the plant itself into an insecticide to make it resistant to certain pests. And we were surprised because the measure lost 70 to 30. One of the reasons, I think, for this was a large infusion of cash from corporate agribusiness, most of which was headquartered outside of the state of Oregon, and we were outspent $5.5 million to $200,000, and there was lots of misinformation promulgated in ads, both on TV and radio, saying that labels were unnecessary, they would scare people, people would not be able to understand them, but more, I think, directly hitting the voters' pocketbook, saying that this could cost up to $1,400 extra per family per year to pay for the labeling, which was really ironic and absolutely patently false, because when they introduced labeling in the European Union, there was no increase in the cost of food. And in fact, we label lots of different foods for things like iron fortified and 30% less cholesterol or new and improved. One of the vice presidents of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has come out against Measure 92, was quoted as saying that, in fact, labeling doesn't increase the cost of producing these products at all. But I think that scared people. They were worried about their food bills going up, rightly so, because there's a lot of food insecurity in Oregon, and the measure failed. But we're back at it, and there was a ballot measure in California, which almost passed, lost by a few percentage points. Then another one in Washington just last year, which lost by 1 or 2 points. And now I think we have a very good chance.
And a lot's happened in the intervening years, too. We have a much larger organic farming market. We have a lot more people very concerned about these things. We have them concerned about pesticides in general. I hope we have a more educated populace that may be able to do something. And then, of course, there was the win in Jackson County.
Right, to actually outlaw the planting of GM crops.
And there will be one somewhat similar to it here in Benton County in May. So your talk tonight, I've looked at the agenda, the contents. It covers a lot of things. I'll just mention them, and then I want to ask about one particular example to illustrate some things. He'll be talking about GMOs. And under that, about food justice and corporate agribusiness, health and environmental risks, labeling, solutions, and resources. But about the GMOs, I'll ask you now to talk about one that's pretty well known called golden rice. The industry claims that golden rice will do some excellent things, and yet when you look under the surface, there are some problems. I thought it would be good to talk about that in connection with food justice and, of course, the economics of farming.
Great. It's interesting because the companies that produce genetically modified seeds and crops are very few. In fact, if you go back to the 1970s, there were 7,000 different agribusiness corporations involved in seed production. None of them controlled more than 0.5% of the market. Today, just 10 companies control 73% of global proprietary seed sales. And in fact, just three, Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, control 53%.
Have they driven other companies out?
It's mostly been mergers and consolidations, but they have driven some other companies out. It's interesting because genetically modified foods are advertised as being the solution to world hunger and to global poverty and to a major problem that kills basically 6 million children every year, hunger and malnutrition. That's essentially one Hiroshima every 8 days. And in the United States, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, food insecurity and hunger affect 20 to 25% of Americans. And so if one were to believe the corporations that this was going to be the solution to world hunger, then there would be a strong argument in favor of them. However, if you look at GE crops, there is not a single commercially available crop that's drought resistant, salt or flood resistant, anything that which increases yields. And if anything, these crops undermine food and nutritional security and food sovereignty and food democracy. And we can talk about that when we speak to the issue of world hunger and the use of GE foods as a bargaining tool to try to get poor African countries during famine to accept GE products, which in fact would devastate their export markets and worsen famines and worsen poverty. But you mentioned golden rice. Now, vitamin A deficiency is a big problem in developing countries. It causes blindness in 350,000 children each year, and lesser deficiencies can weaken the immune system, increasing the risk of infectious diseases, diarrhea, respiratory diseases, malaria, and that's associated with about 1 million deaths per year, those lesser vitamin A deficiencies. So golden rice produces beta-carotene, which is a chemical that is converted into vitamin A by the body. And that is assuming certain things, that there's no other nutritional deficiencies, zinc deficiencies, protein, fat deficiencies, the child's not suffering from diarrhea. So already there are a number of individuals that would not receive any benefit.
And the beta carotene, that's in carrots, right?
Beta carotene, yes, and it's a prooxidant. Now, the golden rice crop itself has gone through a number of different iterations, but they're really not at the point yet where the crop is adapted to local climates. There's two different kinds of rice that can be produced, and the early versions used a rice which is basically nothing that locals eat in the countries where it's been tested. It's something that doesn't grow well under the local soil and water conditions. And the amounts produced in the so-called golden rice are so minute that a child would have to consume literally multiple cups of rice, something clearly beyond the child's gastric capacity to take.
Or desire, I bet.
Or desire, certainly. And also the investigation of golden rice has been marked by some quite troubling violations of basic medical ethics. So there was a feeding trial conducted in Chinese children by Tufts University, which was backed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that was done without any preceding animal studies. And in fact, the parents of the children who were fed were not informed that their children were being fed genetically modified rice. So this is a violation of the Nuremberg Code, the basic code of medical ethics. And that paper got published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. But after criticism in the journal Nature and a number of ethicists came out criticizing this trial, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition is going to retract that study this year. But if we wanted to fix vitamin A deficiency, there's ways to do this. It can be fixed with breast milk and with small to moderate amounts of vegetables whose cultivation, ironically, has decreased as countries have gone more towards monoculture and crops for export, things like cocoa for chocolate and coffee and things that are designed to improve the export economy but may not necessarily provide food and nutrition for the local population.
So the farmers are really induced to give up their subsistence farming and providing food for their own families.
Absolutely. And there are a number of crops produced through traditional agriculture and traditional breeding that have high levels of vitamin A and that are much cheaper to produce. And finally, another way to do this would just be to provide vitamin A and zinc supplements to malnourished infants and toddlers under age 2. And that would cost about $60 million a year, but the benefits in terms of prevention of blindness, malnutrition, and so on would be greater than $1 billion a year. And it's not often in public health that you come along an intervention that costs so little and delivers so much in economic benefits on the back end. So really, the solution to vitamin A deficiency involves traditional agriculture, farming methods that have been perfected over 10,000 years, working with local populations, getting public health experts on the ground, improving breastfeeding, improving the status of women, and really, ultimately, political and social will.
Well, golden rice is one thing that's being touted, and it has some problems. GMO corn bothers me in some ways because, you know, another problem we've had with corn is that a lot of it's being used for ethanol to move cars. And then another thing is corn syrup, which is put in a lot of these same foods. And, of course, the labeling was great in that issue because if you want to avoid corn syrup, you just read the labels. And and I've benefited a great deal. I suppose everybody has from that. Talk about corn as a problem in the genetically modified variety.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll agree with you in that high fructose corn syrup has been a major contributor to the obesity epidemic, both in the United States and now an epidemic which is spreading throughout even the developing world. So there are as many people worldwide, even in developing countries, who suffer from obesity as suffer from malnutrition and hunger. In terms of corn production, most of the corn that's made in the United States, over 90%, is for use in agriculture and in the production of biofuels. Much of the rest of it goes into corn syrup, which makes its way into multiple foods and multiple processed foods. And the genetically engineered corn, there are different types. There are types that are designed to resist the corn borer. That's called BT corn, or for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a gene from a bacterium that creates a protein that combats this corn borer insect. And the concept is that if you insert that gene into the corn will be insect resistant. You won't have to spray as many insecticides. The other types of corn that are produced are herbicide resistance. And so what happens is you insert a gene into the corn which makes a protein which lends the corn to being resistant to a certain herbicide. And then you spray the entire crop with that one herbicide, which interestingly is usually, if not almost always, owned by the same company that's making the seed. So they're profiting on both ends, the sale of the seed and the use of the herbicide. And that herbicide is sprayed over the entire field, kills every weed, every invasive plant, but leaves the corn alive because the corn is resistant to that particular herbicide. So what you can imagine, if you look at the fundamental theorem of biology, which is evolution, is that over time, plants will evolve resistance. And so while there was an initial decline in the amount of herbicide used after the introduction of genetically modified crops, subsequently, the amount of herbicide used has increased dramatically. And also we've seen that with the use of insecticides, that's just taken a little bit longer. So there was a drop, and now things are starting to change. You're seeing insects that are toxic to corn that are not killed by the BT-produced molecule and therefore attack and destroy the corn crop. The same thing happened in India with BT cotton, leading to widespread economic devastation and multiple suicides among farmers who basically lost their entire livelihood. And this is to be expected, is that it's basically an arms race. So then what companies have done is they come out and they create varieties of corn that have genes for resistance to multiple pesticides. So then you have to spray two or three or sometimes even up to six in one type, which is called SmartStax corn, which has resistance to six different herbicides and two insects leveled into it.
But then it would seem that the companies would need to develop new herbicides.
They've got the herbicide, so they're going to make even more profit as more herbicide is sprayed. But the problem is that herbicide has effects on all of us. Already each year, there are 5 pounds of pesticides sprayed per person on the crops that we eat. So you're being exposed, if not directly, at least somewhat indirectly, to those pesticides. Plus, pesticides have effects on farm workers, including migrant and seasonal farm workers who already work under abysmal conditions and are exposed to pesticide-related illnesses and injuries. And the EPA has said that just in the United States, U.S. farm workers suffer at least 300,000 of these types of injuries and illnesses. And the National Academy of Sciences has said that the pesticides in our food could cause up to 1 million cancers in the current generation of Americans. And in fact, the World Health Organization has gone beyond that and calculated how many people died over the last 6 years worldwide from pesticides. And that number is 1 million also. So you're talking about large numbers of people that are dying from this arms race where we're using more and more and more and different kinds of pesticides that are quite dangerous and are linked to all sorts of illnesses from autism to Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes, obesity with prenatal exposure, depression, ADHD. And the irony here is that if you look at the anthropological and historical evidence, there's some suggestion that the use of pesticides versus natural pest control methods has actually done more to promote the development of pests, because about 30% of medieval crop harvests were destroyed by pests. And if you look at current crop harvests, it's more between 35 and 42%. This implies that traditional methods of agriculture are indeed more effective. But again, there's no real profit in that. That's just designed to feed people.
In Benton County, we've had some very successful organic farms, and it's amazing. Some of them may have 25 employees and have 45 acres. And by intensively preparing the ground and by weaving various good plants together, they've done extremely well and supported a lot of people on a small amount of ground and done it organically with none of those side effects. And when I first came here, our extension service didn't know the magazine, for instance, Organic Gardening. And now the extension service is actually helping small farmers with some of these issues.
You mentioned the organic farmers. There's 17,000 of them in the United States, and the organic market is growing faster than any other food market. It costs a lot of money for organic farmers to avoid GM contamination. We're talking thousands of dollars a year to set up a buffer zone, delay plantings to avoid cross-pollination. Pesticide drift can be a problem. And so you can devastate an entire crop for a year of an organic farmer if it becomes contaminated with GM crops, for instance, or has too high pesticide levels. There are many countries that won't import GM crops from the United States. And in fact, I should mention on the issue of labeling, there are 64 countries worldwide that require the labeling of GE foods, so including the European Union. So we're really sort of behind the eight ball there. But in terms of world hunger, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization has already said that there's more than enough food produced each year on the planet to feed everybody a diet of about 2,700 calories per day. And again, feeding everyone requires political and social will. To give another example, if we were to just take farm subsidies worldwide, which are often given to farmers to let their fields lie fallow, 1 week is the annual cost of food aid to eliminate hunger worldwide. It's an irony that the U.S., which has very high rates of child poverty and hunger, among the highest in the industrialized world, is home to many of these GE-producing companies. And so a number of different organizations have come out against GM foods altogether. The U.N. Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights has said that poverty is exacerbated by GE foods. It's important to keep in mind, too, that this is all about making money. The reason that corporations exist and keep going, they're obligated to make money for their shareholders. And so the way that most of them operate is by internalizing profits and externalizing costs, be those the health consequences of production of toxic waste from a mine, for instance, or the health consequences that occur subsequent to GMO use, or the environmental effects of the creation of super weeds. These plants cannot be contained. There's been almost 400 documented contamination events worldwide. So we're, for instance, finding genetically modified corn in the highlands of Mexico where there's no GM planting allowed in that entire country. Same thing in Peru. These are the places that are the birthplace of corn. And why are we seeing GE corn there? It's because of the drift. You can't keep the pollen in place. So at a very bare minimum, to come back to Measure 92, what we're just asking is that consumers be given the right to know. So the most fundamental things that we do as human beings is we breathe air, we drink water, and we eat food. And that's what keeps us alive. So I would argue that we have the right to know, especially in a democratic country, what goes into that air, what toxins are released, who's doing it, what we're being exposed to, why there's certain areas of the country where there's much higher rates of asthma and cancer and so on, what's going into our water. And we need to be able to know what's in our food so that we can make choices. If we want to avoid genetically engineered foods, we can. If we're willing to take that risk, we also can. It's quite simple.
And that's what labeling is, and it goes along with the precautionary principle that you will be talking about tonight. Precautions are what good medicine and good regulation, such as of industrial waste, are all about.
That's the fundamental principle of public health, is the precautionary principle. It says that when evidence points to the potential of an activity to cause significant, widespread, or irreparable harm to the public, either its health or to the environment, that options for avoiding that harm should be examined and pursued, even if the harm is not yet fully understood or proven. And so we saw a lot of things throughout the history of public health where there were potential risks identified. For instance, lead in gasoline, lead in paint, the health risks of tobacco. These weren't totally understood early on, but there was enough evidence to say, perhaps we should have a more open, democratic look at whether or not these products should be produced, how they should be labeled. People should have the right to know that there's some suggestive evidence that these products might cause harm. And over time, that evidence accrued and became greater and greater. And in the case of lead and paint and gas and health risks of tobacco, we've seen what's happened. But companies will always delay and try to prevent there from being things like labeling because they're afraid that it's going to scare people away from their products. If they're as proud of genetically engineered foods and crops as they claim to be, then they should want to put that on the label. They should want to have that front and center and in as bold lettering as you can imagine to say, this was made with genetic engineering technology and we are so proud of it, because they claim to be so proud of it and consider it the promise of ending world hunger. And yet most of it really, again, is to engineer crops that are resistant to pesticides, which are made by the same company. It all comes back to the democratic decision-making process and our right as citizens to have the information to decide what we want to put in our mouths and in our children's mouths. And I would encourage people not just to go to my website, where you'll find links to a number of the organizations that are involved in this issue, but to visit the Union of Concerned Scientists, which has over 60 Nobel laureates, has done a lot of intensive research on these crops. There are published reviews. This is good science. And as a physician, I use high technology every night that I'm working in the hospital. So I want to stress that those of us who are in favor of labeling and are concerned about the health and environmental risks of GE crops are not anti-technology. This is about good science, about peer-reviewed science, and also about open science. And much of the air quotes science that's been used to get these products accepted has been proprietary information and studies conducted by industry itself, because industry until very recently has been reluctant and resistant to even providing seeds to independent investigators to carry out their own studies. And those studies are worrisome. It's well known in the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry that if there is a conflict of interest, that if industry is funding or supporting the study itself, that the results are much more likely to come out in favor of that industry's product. And so we need more independent scientific study. But again, it's about democracy, it's about sound science, and it's about our right to know.
Thank you very much, Dr. Martin Donahue.
It's been my pleasure.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.